Donald on the Kitchen talks about food. Donald on the Kitchen talks recipes. Donald on the Kitchen talks about lots of other things on
Community Radio.
Welcome to the Donald on the Kitchen. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
We gather here once a week around our kitchen table to talk about food, farming advice, recipes, and opinions. And we're here at the studios of KHOI Community Radio, in the heart of Ames, Iowa, in the heart of the country, right here. And we're glad that you have joined us today. Well, we've got a little bit of hint of fall in the air. There's, you know, talk that frost is coming soon. The farmer's market has been glorious because, of course, everything is ripe and on the tables, and apples and cider and pumpkins and squash. And if you want to have a good farmer's market experience, go and buy and enjoy some of that good stuff. It just is really good. And
quick, because it's almost over.
Oh my goodness. Yeah, we go through this every year. It was fun to watch the crowds, and it was quite crowded there right at the beginning, because sticking up out of the people, there were bouquets, lots of late season glads sticking up and kind of going up and down the street, and people carrying big pots of chrysanthemums to get us through the fall. So things are good. Well, Donna, what are we going to talk about today?
Well, we're still, this is our third in the series of pantry foods. And, you know, in the midst of all of this wonderful local bounty, I thought, well, let's also discuss the little things that we kind of order from other places, or have traveled to the supermarket shelves from other places. And, of course, there's spice and herbs and other little things that you use to enhance the flavors of all of this wonderful local produce.
Oh, very good. Very good. So even if you don't have a room called a pantry or something like that, all of us have a little shelf or a drawer or some place where we have those long-forgotten little jars that were a really good idea when we made that one recipe a couple years ago, and I bet it's still there. And this show is about learning to don't be afraid of that stuff. Go ahead and use it.
Well, so one of the things I did while I was thinking about this, of course, I have certain companies that I order from for, like, special beans that you can't buy locally, or spices. We did last week, we talked about burlap and barrel. But I also got some new cookbooks that talk about the larder or the
pantry.
The pantry. Because we talked about the first one, which was the New York Times No Recipe Book or something like that.
No recipe. This book is just, it's wonderful pictures, wonderful descriptions, and just kind of a list. So you take some of this and some of that, which I think is just the way I cook anyway. Anyway, that was a good inspiration.
Yeah, each of these books has a list in them of what is on the shelves of the person who's writing the cookbook. So the other one that we did is Ottolenghi, who was very Mediterranean, has a new book called Ottolenghi Test Kitchen. It's called Shelf Love. And in that book, they talk about ingredients that they keep. You know, there's a list here of cans and jars and spices, what else does he have on his list? I got to turn the page here. Oh, it's a whole fold-out page. Legumes and grains and baking and nuts and seeds. And you know, like, for example, in his spice list, he has, of course, things that he uses for the Mediterranean cook. Black mustard seeds, caraway seeds, cardamom, chili flakes, cinnamon, cloves, cumin, curry leaves, curry powder, et cetera, et cetera. And we have talked a lot about his different books. So I am enjoying this book, but the one that I'm really excited about is something called The Modern Larder. I do not know this writer. She is not a restaurant chef, so I had never seen her work before. This is her second book, but her name is Michelle McKenzie. She's a young-ish cookbook writer. And taught in culinary schools in San Francisco and other places. She just calls it the modern larder, from anchovies to yuzu, a guide to artful and attainable home cooking. So this is geared toward the home cook. She starts out with a definition of larder. The area in the house used for storing food. This includes pantries, refrigerators, cupboards, and other areas that hold culinary ingredients such as dry legumes, nuts and seeds, cultured dairy, canned goods, pickles, ferments, spice blends, cured meats, preserved meats, and grains. So she starts her book. Now, the thing is, everybody is going to have a different selection of things that they keep in their kitchen. And of course, sometimes, you know, it changes and, you know, but I have actually a whole separate room that is my pantry, and it is always full to bursting no matter how much I use. It just like seems to multiply in there, and it's often quite jumbled and out of control, but I know where everything is and I can find it. Probably no one else can find it, but you know. So her list is, you know, different from mine. And what I got excited about this book is she is really pushing my envelope. So while there are many ingredients that are quite familiar, there are some that I think, oh, you know, really, I need to try that. She uses some Asian ingredients that I never heard of, or I haven't really worked. I mean, I've heard of them, but I haven't worked with them. So it's challenging my brain in a way that I really like, because around, you know, like when I lived in California, there were always new restaurants to go to and so many different chefs around that you could, you know, you go and go, I think I'm going to kind of steal that concept, and you go home and make it yourself. And plus, of course, in a larger urban area, especially a coastal area, the range of ingredients that you can get is much wider. So I have picked a few ingredients here that I know can be had either through mail order or, you know, and we're going to just kind of go through what she's using. So because in the beginning of her book, she kind of goes A to Z, you know, starting with anchovies and ending with yuzu, and talks about the specific ingredients. And then the rest of the book is full of really innovative recipes. So the first one that I picked that I know we can get here, because you can order it from Burlap and Barrel, which for the last couple of years I've been using, and also it's in a lot of Ottolenghi recipes too, is dried lime, because it is actually... Dried limes are also known as limu omani, black lime, Persian lime, and they hail from the Middle East. She says, I mean, you can buy them whole. I'm not sure, maybe in a Middle Eastern store, but I know Burlap and Barrel has them in powdered form, which is really easy to use, let me tell you. So it tastes like lime, kind of. And we talked about it last... Actually, we tasted it last week on the show.
Well, we did. Actually, it is black lime. It's ground up black stuff, and you eat it. It has even encouraged me to use this stuff. It is really a nice ingredient. Never heard of it before.
It's the skin of the lime, which has been soaked in water and in salted water, then dried in the sun till it looks like something utterly useless, and then they grind it up. But... She says to use the powder as a solo spice or as a bright, bursty note in blends. It is particularly as a good rub for grilled shrimp, chicken, flank steak. And I often add a pinch to roasting carrots or braising greens such as spinach, kale, and collard. So dried lime is something, you know, you can order other places too, but probably straight away from Burlap and Barrel, which is where I got it. Now, the next ingredients that I picked that she is really easy to find here is fennel seed, for goodness sake. It's something, you know, I really like it. I don't think to use it that often.
No, it's one of those, there it sits, and yes, I have some, and it's, so let's expand our mind about fennel seeds.
Yeah, so she talks about, she also does the other seed that she really recommends that I liked. I thought, I need to use that more, as caraway seeds. So both caraway and fennel, I just have to throw this in because this is something I'm going to try. She has a recipe where you stew the prunes with caraway seeds.
Well, Donna, you're going to stew your prunes
with caraway seeds. I'm going to stew my prunes with caraway seeds. So here's what she says about fennel. Perhaps fennel seed has been familiar enough that it shouldn't be called out here, but much like caraway, I think it has more appeal and a broad range than most people think. It tastes like licorice, but it is also grassy, bright, and floral. And so she has a recipe that I am going to try for candied. Now, this is a big book. Where did I put it? What's it called? Candied seeds, page 351. Oh, I thought I marked all these. Sorry. I must have lost my marker here. So what it is you... okay, here, one more page. There it is. Candied seeds. Make these crystallized seeds one afternoon when the thought of cooking is therapeutic. Good idea, right? Then a few days later when you're feeling more harried and friends unexpectedly drop by and all you have is frozen yogurt or some store-bought vanilla ice cream, these seeds will give you a low-fuss, high-reward dessert. They're also good on the tops of cakes and panna cotta or incorporated into cookie doughs, Lana. Ooh. And anywhere really a sweet crunch is welcome. So to make 1/4 cup, you take the granulated sugar, 2 tablespoons of sugar and 2 tablespoons of water, and you... dissolve it, and then you put the seeds in 1/4 cup of fine seeds, such as sesame or fennel, maybe both. And you line a baking sheet with a parchment paper and put it in the stove. You heat the sugar and water, and then you add the seeds and stir it until the water evaporates.
Okay.
Whoa. So you're really sugaring the seeds sugar.
Okay.
And then you... put them onto the parchment sheet or the silpat, and you let them dry overnight.
Oh, how hot is the oven?
Wait, let's see.
Is it on or just let it dry?
Use a heat-proof spatula. I think you just heat the pan up.
Oh, heat, okay.
And then you spread them evenly, and you let them cool completely. Oh, so you just have the pan hot.
Oh.
And then you kind of air dry and you break them up into crunchy bits. I mean, how simple is that? But what a nice thing to have sitting around. Yeah.
Yeah. And that should, if it's dried, it should store in the pantry just fine.
Well, as long as no moisture can get to it, right?
Okay.
Really keep it in a closed, Tupperware or something with not much air in it. Okay. Another ingredient that she talks about is fish sauce. Now. We now have almost all the grocery stores in town probably have fish sauce in the Asian section. What fish sauce really is basically anchovies. It's very salty and it packs like umami, as they would say, right? A popular brand which really is good is called Red Boat, which I know you can buy it here in town. And, you don't just use it in Asian foods. Like, for example, if you're making a pasta sauce, you can use it instead of salt or, reduce the salt and add that in. And so, like, with tomatoes in your red pasta sauce or like, I'm in the mood to make chili, I may put some fish sauce in the chili just because you don't go, oh, it has fish sauce in it. It just adds one more layer of flavor.
I put a dash, some,
yeah,
in a chicken soup.
Yes, yes, very, very good idea. Don't just think of it as Asian. She also says, surprisingly, fish sauce can be used in desserts. Think of it as an extract like vanilla. Use it to spike caramel sauce, ice cream, or anything with coconut milk.
Ah.
Just be sure to put it in as a drop at a time. Right, because you could definitely overdo it with that. So,
another good tip.
Yeah, I now keep my fish sauce right by the stove and use it instead of salt in a lot of different things.
Ah, good.
So another ingredient that we readily have, you think of it as an Indian ingredient, it's ghee. She says, ghee is liquid gold, a premium pure butterfat with a nutty flavor, and I use it daily in my kitchen. It is clarified butter. You can make your own ghee. You just warm the butter and let it separate, and then you take off all the milk solids. And it is shelf stable at room temperature because you've removed all of the milk products from it.
So the milk solids are the white bits, right?
Yes.
Take out the white bits. Okay.
Yes. And also, unlike butter, if you're cooking with ghee, it because the milk has been removed, you can use higher temperatures and it won't smoke. She says it can be used for pan frying, sautéing, and roasting, and she likes to use it in baking. Yeah. Any recipe that calls for melted butter or melted coconut oil, and as a warm dressing. Yeah. That sounds really interesting. So ghee is something that's readily available, and she's kind of inspired me to maybe rethink using it a little. You know, we get into habits. You know, I saute almost always with olive oil and sometimes with butter and maybe even a little lard, which is her mm-hmm. next thing she talks about, lard.
Even lard, good.
Yes, lard is an ingredient in her pantry and one that we have abundant amounts of around here. She says, although lard suffered long and hard from a wretched reputation, science has redeemed its name. So what she's talking about here is, this is kind of historically interesting. When, at the turn of the last century, of course everyone used lard because, you know, before we had a kind of global or at least national food supply, fat was, you know, it's an important ingredient in your cooking. So most people had access to pigs in this country. So lard was commonly used, as was, of course, butter for dairy. We didn't use olive oil because we don't have a lot of olive oil in this country, except in California. So lard was then, well, what happened is they started making Crisco, which is a hydrogenated fat, you know, and
it is not lard.
It is not lard at all, but it was used to replace lard, and it was sold as the more hygienic form. You don't want to use that dirty old pig fat, da 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 da. Of course, then 50 years later, we find out that the hydrogenated fats used to make the Crisco are actually terribly unhealthy, and that some of the fats that are in lard are healthier. Uh-huh. So that's what she's saying, that it was redeemed by science. She says the texture it creates in food is unmatchable, and this is certainly true in pastries. I made last week, a recipe which I really like is my lard pound cake. You know, I mean, think about replacing it more than in just pie crust. Maybe we should try some lard cookies.
Oh, I've made lard cookies before.
What kind?
When there's a white cookie I make for Christmas. It's just a plain white cookie, and I usually frost it or sprinkle it with mm-hmm. something, and it's just good. And I think I've made peanut butter cookies with lard and peanut butter too. So, yeah. So there.
Yeah. Well, we have plenty of lard, and it's certainly something we should
and
should
pie crusts.
Rethink.
Don't forget pie crusts.
Oh yes, the most obvious place of all. But also, like, just for a quick sauté, you can use lard. This book is making me rethink. Oh yes, right. I could use ghee. I could use lard.
Yeah.
So
here we go.
So many things. She has a whole section here, like, I mean, after she goes through the ingredients, and we are talking about, what's her name? Michelle McKenzie, right? She has, of course, a lot of recipes, and she has a section called Breakfast All Day where she does this thing called, she talks about toast. And she has a page where she lays out, well, it's actually three pages, sweet toasts, savory toasts. And she says, fancy and surprisingly expensive toast is on just about every menu at every restaurant, cafe, and food truck lot in America. Luckily, with the aid of the modern larder and some pre-made foundations and finishes, the unique and hearty open-faced sandwiches are easy to make and enjoy at home.
Yeah.
So you go to a posh restaurant and they're serving you basically toast, right?
Mm-hmm.
So she talks about sweet toasts, where you either, you know, she uses thick slices, right? And you can toast them and then butter them, or you can saute them in the pan with either the ghee or the lard, and then the fat soaks right into the toast. So she has some sweet ones. Okay, here's one with butter, and ghee and,
butter and ghee?
No. Unsalted butter or ghee. Sorry. Hazelnut. Oh, I bought a hazelnut peanut butter, which I ordered online from nuts.com.
See,
hazelnut peanut butter. Hazelnut butter. Butter.
That's right.
Sorry, no peanuts in it. Straight hazelnuts. Really, really good. So that would be good on a toast with some kind of jelly. And particularly if you've kind of sauteed the bread, you could toast it in the toaster, then saute it with the melted lard or ghee, and then put whatever you want on it.
Yeah, treat yourself. That's a nice way to do toast.
And then she has some savory ones, too. Here's one. Olive oil, avocado, and seaweed powder. Okay. She just has things that I wouldn't think of normally.
Right. This is a inspiring and well done book, and it's quite accessible even to those of us who are not chefs by vocation. But my goodness, I can.
Well, we're all cooks. We're all cook. I'm going to be using this one for a long time. You may hear more about it.
Well, good. 20 minutes. So, after toast, do you have anything else?
Oh, well, miso. Okay, right. This is an ingredient I really have used for years. I really would encourage people. There are different kinds of miso. It says, miso is more than soup. Miso is a fermented paste that's made by inoculating cooked and mashed beans, usually soybeans, with shiokoji. That's another one of her ingredients that I have never used. So, but you buy the miso, it's already made. You don't have to worry about the shiokoji. It's salty, it's sweet, it's earthy, and tastes faintly of cheese. Yes, I would say so. It is high in protein, vitamins, minerals, and probiotics. The umami in one small dollop can transform a dish without triggering a, quote, Japanese food label in the brain. Miso is magical. Now, one of the ones that she talks about cooking with, and this is something I do a lot, is mellow white miso is the easiest to incorporate through your cooking. It's salty, of course. It's going to lend that salty flavor. A really easy one is miso mayonnaise. You just take mayonnaise and you mix some of this white miso in it. Now, one thing is if you want to use miso for its therapeutic properties, because it is a lot of probiotics, bear in mind that boiling destroys its probiotic nature. So if you're making miso soup and you want it to be medicinal, kind of, you make your soup broth and you don't, you know, you're cooking it away and then you take it off and you cool it below, you let it cool. I mean, it's still warm because you want it to be soup, and then you can add the miso to it and it will still have its probiotic properties.
Good to know.
But if you're making miso mayonnaise, this is something I stole from the famous Nobu sushi restaurant in L.A. Eggplants, you roast them, and towards the end of the cooking, it's also good on sweet potatoes, too. But you mix the miso and the mayonnaise, and you put it on while it's still in the oven, so it kind of cooks. It's like the sauce on the eggplant or the sweet potato. So she uses it in dressings, marinades, sauce, spreads, condiments. It's salty. So, here's the recipe we wanted to talk about. Miso maple walnuts, page 137. Where's 137? This is something I'm going to try, especially because it seems like a nice thing for the fall. So it's, you need a tablespoon of white miso, a tablespoon of ghee, a half teaspoon of maple syrup, an eighth teaspoon of fine salt, and 1 1/4 cups toasted walnut halves or whole almonds even. You preheat the oven to 350. You combine the miso, ghee, maple syrup, and salt in a small bowl, and you make it into a paste. You add the walnuts, and you toss them, and then you spread them on the parchment paper, and you bake for 10 to 13 minutes until caramelized. Doesn't that sound easy and good?
That sounds very fallish, and it's a good introduction to miso. Thanks, Donna. I want to mention this is KHOI, and you're listening to the Donna Lana Kitchen, Tasty Radio for the Heart of Iowa. Welcome back. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. We're talking about the pantry and the larder, which is places we store things, because we all like to have new tastes in our lives. I want to mention a opportunity I had to kind of revisit my larder. My refrigerator went out this last weekend. It was not fun. I mean, here's all this stuff in, and I did. Freezer and the refrigerator wasn't working. The light was on, and well, we luckily a wonderful man came to fix it and found out that.
Well, and luckily you caught it.
It took out the back part, and there was this large frozen icicle that had gotten down into the moat. I didn't know the refrigerator could do that, but it did it. But in regarding this show, you end up cleaning out your refrigerator, which should be done every couple of years, right? Yeah. So, yeah. Okay.
Yeah, so, definitely.
So you get to the back.
It's a big deal, though.
It's
right?
a big deal. So you get to the back, and yes, there are a lot of these little jars of dribs and drabs, something that you've made yourself, and also some of these wonderful things that you've purchased, the fish sauce, the lard, the miso, tamarind.
Well, what did you find in your refrigerator?
Oh, there was tamarind there. There was some anchovies. I didn't know this back then. And there was a little jar of half-used capers. I assume that capers don't go bad.
Well, most of the capers we get around here are packed in vinegar.
Okay, so they're kind of like pickled.
They're fine.
See, all these little things. So it was a treasure hunt, and I found things. Yes, I did. So Donna is kind of going through a brand new cookbook that we've found called the Modern Larder Cookbook, which is, it just is really, really inspiring. We've gone through a number of good stuff and,
these little ingredients used to like perk up the spice.
Yes,
and flavorings.
And we're here to encourage you to go for it.
Well, what one of her ingredients is, something that is easily gotten here because it's made in Iowa, Nduja.
Never heard of.
Spelled Induja. Okay. Induja.
Are you sure it's made in Iowa? That doesn't sound okay. Very Iowa.
Well, here's, it's okay. Not. It's Induja, is, she calls it a real cook's cheat. So what it is, why it's made in Iowa, we have a company called La Quercia out down in Norwalk, just south of Des Moines, where they make really, really good prosciutto, because what do we have in Iowa? Really, really good pork. So this company's been around maybe close to 20 years, and they make a fine, fine product. And they now have little tubes of Induja, I think probably in all your local grocery stores, certainly Hy-Vee and Wheatsfield, and it's labeled. It does say Induja on the label, but they also called it prosciutto spread.
Ah, okay. I get the idea now.
Yeah, because
okay.
That's Iowa speak for Induja, right? And Induja is a little, it sounds a little intimidating, but so it says 1 teaspoon of this cured spreadable salumi lends enough distinction that a dish needs little else. While Induja is a specialty of the Calabria region in Italy where it is spicy, has a little, from the prosciutto, it's a little spicy, and of course it's salty and it's oily. It says a few U.S. companies now produce great versions. Yes, La Quercia. So because of Induja's intensity and loose texture when cooked, it is not a substitute for ground pork. It's a flavoring. It works kind of like a flavored butter or something. You know, it's the pork fat with, and the aged pork fat, with the flavorings from the prosciutto. It can, however, be used like a highly flavored high seasoned fat brethren, chorizo and pancetta. Saute it as a base for warm dressings, sauces, soups, and greens like kale, collards, cabbage. Eggs. I had some with my eggs this morning.
Not that. Yes. Would be good.
Beans and so on. Make it the foundation of a pasta dish. Spoon some across a platter of, this sounds good, roasted pumpkin or crispy potatoes. Stuff a little scoop into wonton wrappers and deep fry the things. Serve with a simple black vinegar dipping sauce. Shrimp, clams, squid, and octopuses are remarkable pairings. Just keep in mind that Induja gives off a blast of heat, and unlike chorizo or pancetta, becomes relatively grainy when cooked. So that's something we can really easily pick it. And once you open it, it comes in, you know, the little, like, tube. Not a tube,
looks like a stick of butter, sort of?
No, it's
round.
It's round.
Ah, yeah. Sausagey looking.
Yes, sausagey looking. And then, of course, once you open it, you know, you do need to use it within a month or so because it will dry out eventually. But just a little bit goes a long way, and it's really wonderful. And it is widely available, and it is an Iowa product.
Ha! I'm going to give that a try. That sounds good. I'm a fan of saving bacon drippings and cooking.
Exactly.
It sounds like the next level up. I should treat my palate.
Yeah. Think of spicy bacon drippings, right? Okay, so another seasoning. And this, you can order this from Burlap and Barrel. She actually suggests in the book, The Modern Larder, she does mention Burlap and Barrel because they have particularly good sumac. So, sumac, she says, the kebab spice is how sumac was once described to me. It's very Middle Eastern. Indeed, this burgundy-hued spice is used to season grilled meats and their accompanying salads, and its royal color and with a nuanced tang. But what is small box for a tomato? It's a spice. You can sprinkle it on. Think of sumac instead of powdered lemon, only without its searing bite. Truly, it can be used with practically everything. Sumac spice is the ground fried berry from the plant of the same name. I've often purchased, well, she talks about how she tried to make her own sumac and grind it herself. It's really a very hard thing, so she says just buy it.
Oh, good advice. Because we do have sumac plants around here, so I'll take that advice. It's one of those things. Leave it to the professionals.
Right. So it's ground with, it's not ground, it's chopped and preserved in salt with a little bit of oil, like there's to keep it flaky so it doesn't get all gummed up. And it's equitably sourced. ground sumac, you store it in a dry, dark place in an airtight container and use it within 6 months, which should not be a problem. Okay, now, her recipe where she used it, this one knocked my socks off. I'm definitely trying this one soon. Frozen yogurt.
What?
Yeah, she has a really interesting way of making frozen yogurt, and then she uses it as a flavoring. What she does is she says, I have a soft spot for soft serve. I was raised near a beach town in an area in the era of step aerobics and snack while cookies, which meant a lot of visits to the local TCBY for a low-fat cup of yogurt. Achieving a creamy and light frozen yogurt is difficult since yogurt contains a fair amount of water. She said, I've tried many tricks, and the best one is thickening it with meringue. This is something I haven't done, and you know I love to make ice creams and yogurt, so I'm going to try this. So she you know, gives the recipe. Use 6 egg whites and 3.5 cups of plain yogurt. But, you know, she goes into, you make the meringue really, really thick with sugar, and then you mix in the yogurt, and then you put it in your, you know, ice cream machine, right? So that's her frozen yogurt. Then one of the toppings... raspberries or chopped strawberries tossed with rose water and a pinch of granulated sugar and sumac. And then use that as a stir in towards the finishing of the product.
Now that's, oh yes, stir it in. How
raspberries or strawberries, rose water, sugar, and sumac.
Oh, that sounds
doesn't
good.
That sound wonderful?
Oh, it's been a good raspberry year. I think I'm going to have be inspired there.
That's yeah. Good. Well, did you ever think of putting rose water and sumac with your raspberries?
No. I'm so okay. Glad to get raspberries. I just eat them. So, but this sounds really good.
I know. And particularly, I'm fascinated with her putting the meringue in the frozen yogurt. I think that'll make, because it'll give you the texture that you want. So I love, she just has so many good ideas here. I could keep... This is going to keep me busy for a while, I must say.
Good.
So, okay, here's another one. Tamarind. Didn't you say you found some tamarind in the
yeah,
back
I
of your...
Yeah, I found some tamarind, and yes, okay, yeah, I have a recipe. But what is it?
Okay, tangy, sweet, and sour tamarind is a tropical fruit that tastes of molasses, dates, and in fact, its Persian origin, its name means date of India. It's primarily grown in Mexico, Thailand, and some places in Africa. So it's sour. Like I make a tamarind barbecue sauce, which is just really, really, really delicious. And then she goes through a whole thing about, because it comes, you can buy it, it's like a, I don't know, 3 or 4 inch seed pod, and it comes with the seeds and the stems, and she talks about how to process it, but I never bother with that. You can buy perfectly good tamarind, probably in most of the grocery stores around town, and it's thick, like, it looks like molasses, but it does not taste like molasses. So I buy it already processed, or also a lot of Indian stores because they use it a lot in Indian food. So here is the recipe that she uses it. So she has a whole 3 pages on dips and spreads where she talks about making, basically it's like hummus, but different flavors of hummus. So she has something called red lentil hummus, which is 2 cups of red lentils cooked, right? Salt, 1/3 cup of tahini, 2 teaspoons of date syrup, not too much, and then 2 to 3 tablespoons of tamarind paste and 1/4 cup of olive oil.
Ha!
It comes out thick like hummus, but it's not garbanzo beans, it's red lentils. That sounds really easy to make.
And that taste of tamarind, oh, how nice.
Yeah, the tamarind would be, so the tamarind is offsetting the tahini and the date syrup and then the olive oil. There's no garlic in this one.
Good.
Yeah. What? Toppings are spiced ghee or flaky sea salt, and she eats it with roasted vegetables such as pumpkins, carrots, and cauliflower, eggs anyway, fish, fresh smoked or tinned, lamb, rice, or farro. So.
Good.
Red lentil hummus.
Well, we have had lots of information on tickling our taste buds. I'm going to take a little detour here, and we'll get back to good taste. But I want to do a little bit of food history here. This has nothing to do with pantries. This has to do with the story of a muskmelon. There's a muskmelon called the Jenny Lind melon, and it's coming back. It has a resurgence. It is a muskmelon. It is rather large. It is a muskmelon because it is one of those melons that is orangish and has netting on the outside. Well, it looks like netting on the outside. It came to prominence in the middle of the 1800s. At that time, isn't that still, the state of New Jersey was a big garden center, and they had melons. Melons was a big thing there. And they had a melon, and they named it after the famous Swedish opera singer Jenny Lind from the 1800s. She was called the Swedish Nightingale, and they named it after her because, believe it or not, we had the big marketing phase, the mid-1800s, when almost everything was named for Jenny Lind. P.T. Barnum kind of get in on this, too. She was a big hit in Europe, and people decided that, oh, well, bring her over here, we'll have concerts, and they had evidently concert swag to, they were selling sheet music, pianos were named after her, a form of a branded clothing, furniture, baby cribs were named after her, and there was a seed propagator named William Henry Maule, who thought, aha, I'll make my seeds stand out. I'm going to name this melon after Jenny Lind. And he did. And along with all the other things that that were named after Jenny Lind, oh, including towns in Arkansas, California, northern Canada, there's towns named Jenny Lind with the hope of having more people come here. And believe it or not, a polka was named after her. I want to mention this is KHOI. And this is the Donna Lana Kitchen. You can find out more at KHOI, www.khoi.org. Find out lots more about this station. And believe it or not, for those of you who are just going to stay up at night and worry that you don't know what the Jenny Lind polka sounds like, Jenny Lind polka, named after Jenny Lind, the Swedish Nightingale, and there is also a Jenny Lind melon. But here's the polka. Was a Jenny Lind polka. A polka named after a muskmelon and or the famous singer named Jenny Lind, the Swedish Nightingale.
I suppose this melon just sings with flavor.
Well, actually, it is. It's one of those that actually they're bringing it back like Seed Savers.
Because it has an extra good flavor.
It is really good. It is
okay.
Really good. So they
singing go. Melon.
Yeah, melons, yes. And Along with the article about this Jenny Lynn Millen, there's a recipe for a shrub. You've made shrubs before, Donna. Shrubs? Yes. Using melon. A shrub is a drink, right?
A shrub is a kind of a fermented fruit made with vinegar.
Right.
It's an old thing that people used to make beverages out of before soda was invented.
Yes, because it fizzes.
It fizzes a little, but it also is very thirst quenching because whatever fruit you use gives it the sweet flavor, and then the vinegar gives it, not too much vinegar, but it gives it a thirst quenching punch of sour.
Yes, yes, and if you would like to do this sort of thing, the Jenny Lind melon shrub takes one part by weight of a melon with the skin and seeds removed, one part white balsamic vinegar and one part white granulated sugar. You macerate it overnight. Let it sit.
Huh? Well, smash it.
Smash it.
Smash and it and let it sit. Yeah.
Next day, and then let's see.
And then to sit a while, right?
Yeah. And then this isn't very 18th century, but you use an immersion blender, puree all ingredients until smooth, and pass through a cheesecloth-lined mesh strainer, and then you save this juice, this kind of cloudy juice. The shrub will keep for 6 months or more in the refrigerator, but I'm sure you'll drink it before then.
I would hope so.
Oh, yes. But anyway, a shrub. Do you have another fun ingredient for us, Donna?
When I was getting this book, the thing that caught my eyes, of course, she mentions yuzu. Now, yuzu is one of my favorite, rarest, anytime I can find yuzu, I get really, really excited. Yuzu is a fruit. It's kind of lemon-like. The closest thing that you can get to a yuzu fruit in Ames would be a Meyer lemon, right? But yuzu is, it's just the most divine thing. I'm always wishing for yuzu. It says, because of its mysterious flavor, amazing aroma, and subtle tang, yuzu is a favorite of chefs worldwide. Appearing as a perfectly round, rough-skinned lemon, a little larger than a golf ball, yuzu is actually a hybrid of a primitive citrus called Yicheng Pepita, and a sour mandarin orange. It originated in China, but is widely cultivated in Japan. Where you will most likely see it is at a sushi restaurant. It's in Japan, where slivers of its rind are used to accent cooked vegetables, mushrooms, fish, and noodles. Its zest and juice enhance soy sauces, miso toppings, ponzu sauces, and vinegars. Okay, it is now grown in California, and it comes in the citrus season, so they will be coming into season, but you will not see them in Ames. Yuzu, it's just this bright, wonderful flavor. So my yuzu hack for Ames is, at the Asian store, they have something called, it's called citron tea, right? But what it really is some kind of yuzu marmalade, basically. So it has a lot of sugar in it, because I eat it on toast. What it's in Korea, they mix the citron tea. They take the marmalade basically and water it down with hot water and they drink it, right? But it does have the pieces of peels in it and the seeds as well. So I have used the yuzu marmalade in things like ice creams where I want to, it has, if you buy a bottled yuzu juice, which sometimes you can find online, it really doesn't do it for me. By the time it's bottled, it just doesn't taste right. And juiced, you need it fresh. But in the marmalade, you do get that fresh yuzu flavor. So that's my, and you can make your own yuzu ponzu, which is basically just dissolve a little of it in your tamari or soy sauce and you come up with a sort of slightly different flavored, dipping sauce for noodles or something Asian. You can put it in salad dressing.
Yeah, it is very citrusy, very bright, and it's kind of a knocks your socks off kind of lemony taste.
Yeah.
It's good. Very good.
Yeah. So that's the way to get yuzu here in Ames, Iowa.
Well, see, there's lots of things that we can explore. And we're going to repeat this. Explore things. Try new herbs and spices and enjoy new recipes. Go for it.
Donna, right. You will never be bored with your cooking. There's always something new to try, some new flavor, some new way of making things. And that's why from time to time we pick a cookbook, and I use it to stimulate myself because I get tired of cooking the same old things. Yeah. I mean, sometimes I like to cook the same old things, but sometimes you want to try something new.
Sometimes you do. And it's been fun to do this. We've been exploring the pantry, exploring what's on our shelves and closets and refrigerators. We've had fun looking at these three books for pantry inspiration. Today we talked about
The Modern Larder by Michelle McKenzie.
Very good. I like that one. Actually, they're all good. And then we also talked about Otto Lengi's test kitchen called Shelf Love, which is quite nice, too. Again, now you must remember that Otto Lengi is a professional chef, and he has staff. So that's, I mean, it's like the recipes can be a bit daunting, but I dived into one the other.
Oh, you did. She made a really good.
It was called Burnt Eggplant, Tomato, and Tahini. Again, I kind of dug around and found my tahini, and it was good.
It's delicious.
It was fussy, but it was good. And yes, considering this is the end of the garden season, I did actually manage to have some eggplant, and so we had a fine thing. It had a really nice drizzle of a spicy garlic sauce on the top, and then on top of that, you drizzled some tahini, watered down tahini, and that was quite tasty. Yes, it was.
Well, it makes sense because, you know, baba ganoush, which is mashed cooked eggplant, mm-hmm. has tahini, garlic, lemon. So it was kind of like that with some tomatoes strewn in it.
Yeah.
It was delicious.
See, sometimes you want to spend time exploring, and that was kind of my latest explore. We'll have more things because these books are really good. Oh, another book that we talked about for the pantry was the New York Times Cooking No Recipe book by Sam Sifton. And that kind of got us started. It also.
Yeah, all of these books just encourage you to kind of pick and choose ingredients and take off and not, some of them have specific recipes, but the Sam Sifton book is funny because he'll say a glug of olive oil or, you know, just a fistful of this or some. You're encouraged to kind of take a departure from following a strict step-by-step recipe.
Right. And so we've been talking about ingredients and the fun that we have with them these past 3 weeks, and we'll have more fun stuff coming up.
Yes, I'll be reporting back as I try some of these new recipes.
Right.
It's got me going.
Right. Very good. So get your courage ready and try new things. Have a good time. Also, we want to mention that this radio show that we've been doing on the KHOI station for a long time, almost 8 years, Donna, we've been doing it. Making some of these, or most of them, available as podcasts.
Yes, we have the Donna Lana Kitchen podcast. So go to wherever you listen to your podcasts and just type in Donna Lana, which is one word, Donnalonna Kitchen, and you will find our podcast.
That's if you just cannot get enough of us. Well, thanks for joining us today. You've been listening to the Donna Lana Kitchen. We come to you live at noon. We're repeated at 7 p.m. on this fine station, or anytime. You can download us at www.khoyfm.org. Support this fine community radio station. We've had music today by the Barn Owl Band. Thanks for joining us around our kitchen table. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
We had an excellent engineering by Mike Murphy. Eat good food and enjoy life.